You know who the real heroes are? The guys who wake up every morning and go into their normal jobs and get a distress call from the commissioner and take off their glasses and change into capes and fly around fighting crime. Those are the real heroes.
You got a suit? And suit up.
Our hero. He is risen. We all need a hero, and our hero's name is Jesus. What on earth are you doing?
Oh, hey, I heard you're looking for a hero to save the world, so here I am, a real-life superhero at one of your Easter services.
Well, it's kind of you to offer, but with all due respect, I'm pretty sure you're not the superhero we need to save us today. We need Jesus, not Spider-Man.
What? You think I'm Spider-Man?
Well, the suit.
It's the suit, isn't it? Oh, I'm not Spider-Man. I'm Daddy Longlegs Man.
Daddy Longlegs Man?
That's right, Daddy Longlegs Man. So I can't spin a web or fly acrobatically through the air.
But what's your superhero superpower then?
Speed walking!
I see that.
I'm a competitive speed walker.
Wow, you're really fast. But just a thought, have you ever considered running?
Oh, no. Don't run. It's against the rules, and it's an automatic disqualification in competitive speedwalking.
But if you never run, how do you catch the bad guys?
Take a science class, preacher boy. Look, Daddy Longlegs have stink glands. What that means is I can emit a pungent odor to scare my predators away. Here, let me show you.
Oh, no, please. Please, no.
Fine, I gotta run away, or I gotta run in. I gotta speed walk back to my seat over there, so. But before I do, people of hope, I'm always at your service, says, as a superhero to save you and to save the world.
Well, thanks, Daddy Longlegs Man, but I'm pretty sure the risen Jesus is the real superhero we need to save us.
That Jesus, he's a good choice. You know, that resurrection story, man, that's a good one. He's so good. Okay, I gotta go. Bye. Oh my gosh, what do you people?
You never know. Who needs a hero? One better than that one, I hope. Who needs a superhero? I love comic books and superhero movies, and a lot of people do, apparently, because they're very popular. And yet, what we're here to celebrate today is the resurrection of Jesus, a superhero for sure, but he has the audacity to step forward and say, I am the resurrection and the life. And then he backs it up. And then he actually rises from the dead. And we're not talking about fantasy and comic books and fiction and movies and stories that draw us in and make us want to cheer for the hero. We're talking about a real world Jesus. Real life, showed up, lived, died on a cross, and rose from the dead. Now, when you hear that, if you're skeptical or you have doubts, or you got invited, because it's not every day that somebody rises from the dead. It sounds so sensational. It does sound like a comic book superhero type movie sort of thing. If you are there, you've come to the right place. Bring your questions, bring your doubts. We have a whole class here that starts next Monday night that is all about questions that people who are skeptical of Jesus would ask, called Alpha. Thousands of people have taken it here at Hope. Tens of millions have taken it worldwide. It's the biggest move of God in the last generation on planet Earth. And it's all based on a former atheist who became a Christian and wrote this course and said, I know the kind of questions that people who have skepticism about the resurrection of Jesus ask, who have doubts about God, who have doubts about faith. But it turns out faith and facts are friends. The resurrection and reason hang out together. They aren't enemies of one another. When Jesus says, I'm the resurrection and the life, I get it. It sounds sensational. The Apostle Paul, though, in the Bible, in 1 Corinthians 15, he said, look, if Christ hasn't been raised from the dead, then we are most of all to be pitied as Christians by this world. Of anybody else in this world, we are most of all to be pitied. But he goes on next sentence and he says, but in fact, Christ has risen from the dead. And we are witnesses to these things. And if Jesus has risen from the dead, it changes everything. It means that death has been crucified, destroyed, erased on the cross as Jesus dies, because Christianity literally means that we belong to Christ. People who put our trust in Jesus, we belong to him through that faith, through that trust. Trust is a foundation for any good relationship. God wants nothing less than that with us. And so trust draws us into a bond with Jesus Christ. And the Bible puts it this way. If we have been bonded or united with Jesus Christ in a death, a crucifixion like his, we will most certainly be united with him in a resurrection like his. What happens to Christ happens to those who belong to him. And so the good news is there's new life on the other side of Easter for us. There's eternal life, life that goes on forever, because not only has our sin been erased, which would keep us apart from a holy God for eternity, but our death has been destroyed. It has been conquered by the one we belong to. That's the good news of Easter. And it's written into our hearts. We cover it up with our doubts, our distractions, the different things that might be swaying us and assuming, well, you know, Christianity is fine. It teaches some decent morals, I guess, and it does some good. It's out there. It's hopefully usually a force for good, although Christians can certainly corrupt that, making it all about us and pointing you to who we are as a church instead of remembering we're a church of hope. We're a Lutheran church of hope in Jesus Christ. We're not a Lutheran church of hope in us or our programs or our style or our way of doing things. Our hope is in Jesus Christ. Our hope is in this story. Our hope is in the Jesus who lived, died, and rose from the dead, and nothing less will do. Still, we hear this. Okay, eternity's written into my heart. Fine, whatever. Maybe it's just a longing to want to live beyond the grave. Maybe that's true, and maybe there's some people who wish this into existence, who want it to be true so much, we just say, well, I'm just going to say it's true. It's a fantasy then. So for those of you who are skeptical, again, in the right church, you've come to the right place. Bring your questions, bring your doubts, because good questions I have found over the years lead to really good answers, and good answers lead to a much deeper faith. So there are four books that I've recommended over the last 30 years or so as a pastor here at Hope for people who have these questions, who have these doubts, who are skeptical. On the left is a book by the foremost biblical scholar in the world today, N.T. Wright. He wrote an 800 or 900 pager called The Resurrection of the Son of God. He will give you details you don't even care about. You don't even want to know. He'll take you through things. If you're having trouble sleeping at night, this book could help. But it also is robust intellectually, academically. It will take you through every question, every doubt, everything surrounding the resurrection of Jesus Christ. On the other side of the screen is a book by Lee Strobel called The Case for Christ. He was a legal reporter, an investigative journalist for the Chicago Tribune, an award-winning one who would publish articles exposing the corruption in the courts around the Chicago area and different places, and so he was hailed for it. His wife, Lee Strobel's wife, became a Christian. She joined a church like Hope in the Chicago area, and Lee Strobel was just distraught. He was beside himself. He said, my wife has been taken over by the ridiculous people, the people who are senseless, the people who have no basis for what they say and believe. As an investigative investigative journalist, as a legal reporter, he knew is it's just too sensational to believe. She's believing in fantasies. She's believing in, this isn't the wife that I married. I want her back. So the way he set out to do this, maybe not the healthiest way for a healthy marriage, was I'm going to passive aggressively write a whole series of articles for the Chicago Tribune that debunk Christianity. From a legal perspective, I'm gonna approach it as lawyers would. I'm gonna approach it from an evidence-based kind of a look at these things, analysis, and I'm gonna show her. And while I'm at it, I'm gonna show the rest of the world. I'm gonna write these definitive articles that are gonna tell people, oh, sure, if you want to believe in fantasies, go ahead. But the rest of us, rational people, will be over here. And knowing that what you're believing in is just a fantasy. It's just made up. It's a wannabe. You want it to be so bad, you've made it true. Long story a whole lot shorter, several months later, into his deep investigation, Lee Strobel became a Christian. Because of the evidence. Because faith and facts are on the same team. The resurrection and reason, if you dare to actually look at it objectively, like Lee Strobel had an agenda. His agenda was to disprove Christianity. And the deeper he looked into it, the more he realized, I can't do it. I met Lee Strobel at Billy Graham's funeral, and we talked about this. And he's just such a brilliant guy. He's always going to be the smartest guy in the room. It's evidence that led him to faith. It's the evidence of the resurrection where he says it takes more faith not to believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ when you look at the evidence, the history, not just within the Bible, but outside of the Bible and all the things around it. It takes more faith not to believe that this is a real life story, that Jesus lived, died, and rose from the dead. And because it's true, I now consider myself a fully devoted follower of Jesus Christ, he says. And he's not alone. C.S. Lewis was an atheist who became a Christian. He was a professor of English at Oxford University, another rather academically rigorous sort of professor. His friend and colleague, J.R. Tolkien, another professor at Oxford, challenged him. Tolkien is a Christian. He wrote the Lord of the Rings series, which is filled with metaphors that are biblical. And he said, hey, Lewis, I don't know, do you call him C or CS or what do you call him? Hey, Lewis, I dare you to consider the claims of Jesus Christ, to do an objective investigation of the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. C.S. Lewis did, and just like Lee Strobel, he was surprised, shocked even, he said, to discover that the evidence strongly favors that Jesus lived, died, and rose from the dead. Lewis went on to famously say, and I just love this quote of his, that if Jesus rose from the dead, as I now believe he did, it's the most important thing ever in the history of this existence, of this planet Earth. If Jesus didn't rise from the dead, then it's of no importance whatsoever, and we should stop talking about it like it's true. And we should just say, hey, you know, we're going to get together on Sundays just to talk about trying to be better people. But Christianity is so much deeper than that. Lewis goes on to very persuasively argue, as if Christianity and the resurrection is true, then it's the most important thing ever. If Christianity isn't true and the resurrection didn't happen, it's of no importance at all. What it can't be logically, Lewis goes on to say rather persuasively, is moderately important. And yet, if we're going to be honest, that's what it is for most of us and for most Americans. Moderately important. The resurrection, Christianity, Jesus. I mean, I've got more important things going on. I got my bracket pool. I've got teams that I cheer for. I've got passions and hobbies. I've got a career. I've got family. I've got friends. I've got social circles. I'm trying to become social media famous, somebody could say. That's what life's all about. No wonder we're so empty. Because we're chasing the wind of this world, thinking that it's going to satisfy our souls. And it's not the world's fault. It just doesn't have the potential to do it. Lewis is right. Christ can't be moderately important. His resurrection is either the most important thing that ever happened in human history or it's of no importance whatsoever. Simon Greenleaf was a lawyer back in the 1800s, and he got hired to become a professor at Harvard Law. And now through our vision today, we think of Harvard Law School, elite, one of the elite law schools in the world. And it set out to be that in the 1800s, but by the time Simon Greenleaf showed up, they had one professor and six students. Six. They were about to close their doors. The other professor who was there when he showed up retired, so it was just him. And then, according to the Harvard Law website, Simon Greenleaf saved Harvard Law School. Completely turned it around, started to build it up to become what it is today. By teaching this whole discipline called moral law. And in the midst of teaching moral law, he wrote exhaustive essays from a legal perspective that still influence the legal system to this day. And Greenleaf, one of his most famous ones, was about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. He challenged his students and himself. He says, let's look at the evidence the way good lawyers would, before a jury. And let's consider the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus or not for the resurrection of Jesus. Either it happened or it didn't. Christianity, unlike any other major religion, is based on a public event that actually happened in front of a whole bunch of people, not some private spiritual guru who says, this is my vision I got, and so you just have to believe it. It happened out in public or it didn't. And so he says, there's got to be some evidence that we can find historically, either for or against. And he looked into it and he concluded at the end of his exhaustive essay, there's more evidence for the historical fact of the resurrection of Jesus Christ than for just about any other event in all of history. The resurrection and reason are friends. Faith and facts do hang out together, as it turns out. So for the rest of this sermon, I want you to imagine you're the jury. A few more than 12 are here. And I'll be the lawyer, and I say that with some trepidation, because I know I'm preaching to some lawyers and some judges, and you've been very kind and gracious about it on the way out. We're gonna have to suspend some courtroom rules that you know and I don't know, and there's a right way to do this and probably a wrong way. That's not my goal here. I just want to point you to the evidence. So, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, Exhibit A, the cross of Jesus Christ. The claim is that Jesus lived and died on that cross, and there isn't any historical scholar, who takes the whole thing seriously, who disagrees with that. You can Google almost anything you want. You can find somebody who says Jesus never lived, Jesus was never nailed to a cross, he was never crucified. But even the scholars, the historians who are atheists and agnostics say that's embarrassing. Clearly Jesus lived, they say. That's not the issue. Clearly he was crucified. He led a movement. It was a big deal. It was a threat to the province of Judea where Jerusalem was seated, a threat to the establishment, a threat to their governor, Pontius Pilate, a threat in a sense to the Roman Empire and that region of the Roman Empire, a threat to the temple priests for sure, because Jesus was moving in a whole different religious direction than the narrow-minded legalism of the temple priests of Jesus' day. So they nailed him to a cross because they had the power to do it. They're the Roman Empire. We're not talking about a weakling government here. You're a threat? Oh, we'll take care of that. We'll silence the threat. We'll crush your whole movement. You get hailed as a king coming into our city, coming into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday. By Friday, we'll have you dead. There is not one serious, scholarly historian who disagrees with that. All the evidence points to this. And only those who are off the rails would suggest there was no Jesus and that the crucifixion didn't happen. All of history points to this. But here's the surprising thing. The evidence of history also points to the resurrection. And why is this Exhibit A and why does this matter? Because it means Jesus wasn't taking a nap when he came up out of the tomb. It means he was dead. Roman soldiers were trained at crucifixion sites, execution sites, to make sure that the body was medically dead before it was pulled off the cross. Pastor Caroline talked about this in her Good Friday sermon just a few days ago. And as Pastor Caroline always is, she was right on historically. She said, if a Roman soldier pulled somebody off a cross before he was medically dead and it was discovered, he would be nailed to the next cross. It was a capital crime for a Roman soldier. So those soldiers had every motive to make sure Jesus was dead. There's no debate that he lived and died, no serious debate that he lived and died on a cross. But there are some who start to come up with some really sensational stories. Oh, he just fell asleep. He just fell asleep getting crucified. He took a little nap, and then he woke up, and Exhibit B, he pushed away a 2-ton stone all by himself. That was sealed by the Roman Empire, again, not a weakling government, and roped to that tomb so that it couldn't be busted out because the Roman Empire didn't want any rumors to start. So here's this tombstone that Jesus wouldn't have been able to move physically by himself unless he can do miracles, which he can. But then there's also the disciples, the rumor that they somehow, or the claim that the disciples somehow broke through the regiment of Roman soldiers, 16 of them guarding the tomb. The tax collect, how many tax collectors do you know could take on Roman guards armed? Fishermen. They're going to take over the Roman guards. They're going to push away the tombstone. And then, exhibit B, they're going to see the linen wrappings. And they're going to see the head cloth, famously called the shroud. But it's a head cloth, basically, that's on the bed, the stone slab, where Jesus' dead body was lying. And they notice that it's all folded up. Exhibit C. This is not the best point, but it's worth noting. And it's one of the most fun. If you ever had your house burglarized, did you know that, did the burglar stop in your bedroom and make your bed on the way out? If the disciples broke through the 16 Roman soldiers, pushed through the tombstone, and pulled Jesus' dead body out, and then what, Peter's going to say to Thaddeus, hey, Thaddeus, make sure you make the bed on the way out. We want to leave it neat. It just doesn't make sense. What? Why was the head cloth folded up? Because Jesus was in no hurry. He just like, oh, well, here we go. He is risen. The disciples weren't claiming that Jesus rose from a nap. They were claiming he rose from the dead. The tombstone has been rolled away, exhibit B. The headcloth is folded up. It's not exactly the activity sort of norm for burglars or thieves. Exhibit D, the tomb is empty. Nobody debates that either. There's no body in the tomb. The question is, why? What are the plausible answers? The disciples stole it? What's their motive? Because if they start this whole Christianity religion just because they want to, what they're starting is basically an absolute certainty that they'd live a life of poverty, that they would be threatened, that they would be imprisoned, that they would be executed. 11 of the 12 apostles were executed. 11 of the 12 for their Christian faith. These are the same disciples who are hiding out in fear when Jesus is crucified on the cross. The only one of the 12 disciples who's there is John and some of the women who are clearly very strong, stronger than the men in this group. And they are there, but everybody else has abandoned Jesus. Give them a break, though, for pretty decent reason. Because if they're putting your leader on a cross and executing him, and they associate you with the leader, you might be next. So those disciples who are hiding out are suddenly going to become the most bold public proclaimers of the good news of Jesus' resurrection, even though it means they could die for it, and most of them did. What's your motive? Wouldn't you think one of them would have cracked? Wouldn't you think one of them would have said, hey, you know what, before you nail me to that cross, we made it up. Why wouldn't one of them have broken? Why wouldn't one? And it wasn't just the 12 disciples. It's up to 500 plus witnesses, the Apostle Paul says. Where's the body? Because the Roman Empire had all the power to find the body. The temple priests had power to find the body. They could have put it on display in front of the temple and said, hey, let's have a funeral visitation. Stop saying he's risen from the dead. He clearly hasn't risen from the dead. He's dead. And Christianity was already exploding because of the resurrection now in growth. People were going around publicly and saying, he is risen, so they made it illegal. Pontius Pilate, the governor of this province, orders a Roman soldier or a regiment of them to go out and investigate this. In a movie called Risen, which I love, which came out about 8 or 10 years ago, Pilate, in the scene you're about to see, tells Clavius, this fictional character, but there was somebody like Clavius, that Pilate told, you have to investigate this. Because the Roman Empire has everything to lose. We don't want a new king. We've already got a Caesar. We don't want someone to be a threat to Pilate. We already have a government here. We don't want a new one. We don't want an overthrow. We need to push this back. And if there's rumors that the leader of this band of disciples, these Christians, these followers of the way, have a king of all kings who's risen from the dead, how do we compete with that? We got to find the body. So Pilate gets that whole investigation in motion. Take a look.
You will track down each and every one of these disciples, but more importantly, you will find the corpse of this cursed Yeshua before it rots.
Bring the Arimathean.
You, get the Arimathean.
As if they burst.
Where has he gone?
You tell me. The body, was it anointed?
We have no time. We just wrapped him with myrrh and aloe.
That's what you see. Sweat and herbs, bring it.
I want nothing touched here. Post a watch, and everything leaving Jerusalem searched. Arrest anyone claiming the Nazarene lives and find out where they heard it.
That's true.
He's determined. He's going to leave no stone unturned. Imagine you're in his sandals. What would you see if you looked inside of the what now? What is going on?
Hey, I got a big delivery for the church. If you could sign here.
During the sermon? Really? Well, what is it?
I'm on a time crunch here, and I'm guessing you are too.
Hold on a minute. I think I recognize you. Aren't you that Daddy Longlegs man who was here earlier?
Well, maybe I am. But it's my secret identity. There's not really a huge demand for a speed-walking superhero, you know what I mean? This is a side hustle.
Well, that makes sense, but who do you work for? Amazon, FedEx, UPS?
Oh, come on, man. We've all combined. We're now called Emma Fed Up. Come on,
yeah,
guys.
Sure,
bring
right.
that in here. Let's go.
Well, this is the
delivery? A little quicker than that.
What is it? What do we have?
Well, looks like there's about 25,000 ancient biblical manuscripts here, and they're for you, and claiming that Jesus did, in fact, rise from the dead.
Yeah, that's great. Wow,
yeah,
but
ahead,
don't leave them here, because we don't have room for that. That's going to make a mess. Oh, wow. Okay,
go.
So that's a lot.
Thanks.
That's a lot.
Thanks. Hey, just a second. I got to do this, because that's what we do. All right. See you. Got to go.
So you'll email that to me then? That's great. Exhibit E. The manuscripts from the New Testament that archaeologists are still finding more and more of all the time. How do you want a number it? The Emma Fed Up delivery guy said 25,000. That's a big, bold estimate. Others say, well, actually, there's just 5,800 Greek manuscripts, and the New Testament was written in Greek. You can only get to 25,000 if you add in the Latin and the Armenian and all the other languages it was translated into. Textual scientists, who are direct cousins of archaeologists who study this, debate these things all the time, but at a minimum, let's take the most conservative number. There's 5,800 plus Greek manuscripts, ancient manuscripts that have been dug up in archaeological digs, and they're still, that number is growing all the time. It's pretty aggressive. And here's the thing I want you to know about those manuscripts. First of all, that they match, that they line up 99% of the time, which is unheard of when it comes to manuscripts. From the first century manuscripts they find all the way through the 14th century, they say the same thing. So much for those who suggest that the Bible we're reading today, we have no way of knowing if it's the Bible that was written once upon a time. Textual scientists will tell you there's no other document that comes even remotely close to how reliable our New Testament manuscripts are because they match, they line up, they say the same things in all these different languages, but they say the exact same things over and over and over again, which means they're legitimate copies. Textual scientists will also say the way you measure reliability of these ancient texts is you look at two things. Number one, how many copies do you have? So let's take the most conservative number, and let's say that there's 5,600 plus of those. Compare that to other things we believe from ancient times, about the same time as the life of Christ. I believe Julius Caesar lived. I believe he fought the battles that history says he fought. I believe that it's real. Do you know what I base that on and what you base that on if you believe that too? 9 documents. That's all archaeologists have ever found that detail the life of Julius Caesar. 9. And then there's a 1,000-year gap between the time Julius Caesar lived and the first document we have dated to a century that was 1,000 years after Julius Caesar lived, which is the second thing textual scientists look at to test the reliability, is what's the gap between when these events actually happened and the earliest document or manuscript that we have detailing what happened. The closer, the shorter, the smaller that gap, obviously the more reliable. The more copies you have that say the same thing, obviously more reliable. 9 for Caesar, 5,600 plus minimum conservative estimate for the New Testament claiming Jesus rose from the dead. You say, oh, you're just fixing the whole thing. You pick Caesar because there's only 9. That's pretty much what it is for everything we believe about ancient history around that time, 3 or 4 centuries either way from the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. The only thing remotely close, and it's not even in the ballpark, is Homer's Iliad, which has, like, at last count, I think it was 187 copies. And again, 1,000-year gap between the time Iliad actually supposedly wrote, or Homer actually wrote the Iliad, and when we have the most ancient manuscript saying, well, here it is. But I believe it's probably him. That's how textual science goes. There is nothing even close to the reliability of the New Testament, so we can trust that what we're reading when it says Jesus rose from the dead is what was written and what was testified to. So it's great to have all this physical evidence, the cross, the tombstone, the folded grave cloths, the empty tomb, the ancient manuscripts and their high reliability, of which nothing else even comes remotely close. The New Testament manuscripts, between the time Jesus rose from the dead and the first ones written, Paul wrote his letter to the Corinthian church about a decade or two after the resurrection. Not 1,000 years, a decade or two after. In that letter to the Corinthian church, the Apostle Paul says, if you don't believe me, ask the 500 witnesses who saw Jesus risen from the dead. We all know he died. We all know he was laid in a tomb. But then, remarkably, we saw him alive again. And it's not just me, and it's not just the 12 disciples, plus the women who were following Jesus' disciples. It's not just our small group of 10 or 20 or 30 people. There's 500 people at once who saw Jesus risen from the dead. And then Paul's practically daring people in the Corinthian church who have doubts about Jesus' resurrection. If you don't believe me, ask the people who were there, because many of them are still alive. What do you see when you look into the history of the empty tomb? What's the most plausible explanation? What if we could go back in time and talk to some of those 500 witnesses that Paul writes about? Or what if they showed up right here and right now at this Easter service to testify on the witness stand about what they saw and about what they experienced nearly 2,000 years ago on that first Easter Sunday? And here they come. I know you can't do 4 witnesses at once in a courtroom, but like I said, I'm a pastor, not a lawyer. And I just want to show you the evidence. So welcome Doubting Thomas and John the Beloved Disciple and Mary Magdalene and Simon Peter. Please place your hand on the Bible and take the oath.
The books that I wrote or the books that he wrote?
Well, it's all good. So here we go. Do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
We do. And the truth will set us free.
That's from your gospel, John.
John 8, verse 32.
That's true, but I'm just quoting Jesus. It's his truth, not mine, that sets us free.
So let me ask you about that truth, about what really happened on that first Easter Sunday. When did you know something unusual was going on?
I knew right away at sunrise. I went to the tomb of Jesus with some other women from our group to anoint Jesus' body with some burial spices.
Jewish Sabbath laws prohibit any work on Saturday, so Sunday at sunrise would have been the first time that Mary could have legally carried out our burial customs.
Yes, right. But when I arrived, I saw that the stone that's normally in front of the tomb had been rolled away to the side. And then when we looked into the tomb, we saw that the tomb itself was empty. Definitely was not expecting that.
Well, what were you feeling in that moment then, Mary?
Well, I was feeling so many different things: confusion, anger, fear. But mostly it was just sadness. There was maybe a hint of hope, but it was really just a lot of deep grief for me right after Jesus died. And then to arrive that morning, prepared to do one thing, but to realize that the body was gone, it was really overwhelming.
But Mary is strong, and she ran back and told Peter and me that the tomb was empty.
So what did you do then, John and Peter?
What did we do? We ran. We ran straight to the tomb. That's what we did.
Right, and it's kind of a long run, so obviously I got there first.
Okay, marathon man. Anybody who reads your gospel knows that, you know, you were one of the first ones to believe, and you were the fastest, and you're the beloved disciple.
Sure. Jesus did call me those things, but it's because I'm the youngest, not the best. In fact, Peter, you were his right-hand man. He called you the rock.
I know. I love that part. It meant so much to me.
We all loved it, Rocky.
But I failed him. I did. Mary, you stood there with Jesus at the cross, and you were there too, John. But the rest of us, we were no-shows of the resurrection. We were all too scared. We were too busy because we were betraying him. We were denying him.
Hey, Rock, it's all good. All is forgiven.
Tell the jury more about what you were feeling, Peter, in that moment.
I felt devastated. I mean, I denied Jesus 3 times. It was just like he said I would do, and just like I promised I wouldn't.
Well, I had my doubts, but it was a scary night for all of us. It felt like everything that we had and everything that we knew was just falling apart.
Sure, but I was supposed to be there for him. I was supposed to be his rock.
You know what, though? A few weeks later, he picked you up. Remember we were all fishing back home in Galilee?
Yeah. Now that was a great day.
We caught 0 fish all night long.
That's true.
And then when Jesus shows up, so many fish start jumping in the net, we can barely pull it in. And Peter over here starts jumping for joy when he sees the risen Lord. He jumps straight out of the boat and races back to shore.
I've never been so excited in my whole life. I couldn't wait to see Jesus. But then, after breakfast, he said, let's go for a walk. Just me and him. And you know what? He restored me.
I wrote about that in my final chapter of my gospel. 3 times, Jesus asked Peter, truly, do you love me as a fully devoted follower?
Once for each of the times that I denied him and fell away, Jesus offered me a chance to receive his grace. And I'll never forget that. It changed my life forever.
And then he told you to take care of his sheep, his church, and to be his follower.
Yeah. Jesus gave me a do-over. He told me to follow him again at that exact same place where he called me the first time to be his disciples. And once again, he made me a fisher of men. I'm completely restored. It's changed me forever.
That was a really good day.
Yeah.
You know, Mary, didn't you also have a life-changing one-on-one conversation with the risen Jesus, only it was back in Jerusalem on that first Easter morning?
Yes, I did. After I told Peter and John that the tomb was empty, we all went to see it, but then when they both left, I just stayed just by myself, or at least that's what I thought.
Wait, someone else was there?
Yes, 2 angels were there, just casually, angels, sitting on the stone tablet where Jesus' body had been laid, and they asked me, why are you crying?
Well, what did you tell them?
Well, I told them Jesus' body was missing because I thought that maybe they would know something and they'd be able to help me out. And then I turned around and there was a man standing there.
Huh. Was it another angel?
No, it was even better than another angel. At first, I thought this man was the gardener, but then he asked me, why are you crying?
Oh, wow. Same question. Was that a coincidence?
No, not at all. Jesus knew exactly what my grieving heart needed to hear. And then he called me by my name. He said, Mary, and it just... It took.
Weeping may last through the night, but joy comes in the morning.
Psalm 30, verse 5.
Okay, Thomas. Thomas, I felt the full power of God's love for me when he called me by my name, and that's when I knew it was Jesus, not the gardener. It was his voice. And right at that moment, I knew I was looking at Jesus, risen from the dead, right in front of my face.
But you knew that it was Jesus right away, Mary. It took me longer to know and longer to believe.
Thomas, you rather famously refused to believe that Jesus had risen from the dead. You had your doubts, didn't you?
Yeah, but I am not the only one amongst us who had their doubts, okay? It's not exactly a regular, everyday thing for someone to rise from the dead.
Even though Jesus had told us 3 times before that he would rise from the dead.
Yes, I heard him say that too, John. I was there, but the truth is that most of us disciples, we actually didn't know what Jesus meant when he said he was going to rise from the dead, at least not back when he first said it.
It sounds then, Thomas, and ladies and gentlemen of the jury, like, Thomas, you weren't sure whether Jesus was promising to physically rise from the dead, or perhaps he was just offering to bring some sort of metaphorical spiritual renewal to our world after he died.
Right. I wasn't sure back then. But now I know, and now I believe, Jesus rose from the dead physically in the real world without a doubt.
Oh, the resurrection's real. I saw Jesus die on a cross on a Friday. And then I saw that same exact man alive again 3 days later on a Sunday. His resurrection, it changed us as disciples.
Think about it. Overnight, we went from being scared and hiding in the dark to doing everything we could to tell every single person about this truth of Jesus raising from the dead. This news of Jesus raising from the dead is something that we sacrificed our lives for. So many of us have died, even though it took us, some of us, more than a minute to get there.
It definitely took me more than a minute. Listen, yes, I had my doubts, but I didn't want to be some impractical religious guy who believed in fables simply because I wished that they were true. I wanted to see it to believe it.
And then he saw it.
I sure did. Jesus just appeared right in the middle of the house that we were hiding out in. He showed me the wounds in his hands. I saw the proof of the resurrected Jesus before my very eyes, and it blew my mind.
So what did you do?
I fell to my knees and said, "My Lord and my God."
It's my favorite part of the story.
I'll tell you my favorite part of the story is what Jesus said next. Jesus looks at me and he says, it's changed everything for me. He said, "Thomas, you believe in me because you've seen, but blessed are those who believe without seeing me."
Yeah, the whole we walk by faith, not by sight thing.
Right, but it turns out there's a mountain of evidence to support Jesus' resurrection, but even better, we've got God's word on it. And our belief in God's promises reveals a deeper truth that evidence alone cannot see.
No doubt about it, Thomas.
No doubt about it.
Well, thank you, Thomas. Thank you, John. Thank you, Mary. Thank you, Simon Peter. We praise God for your proclaiming of the timeless truth of the good news of Jesus' resurrection for all these centuries. Let's give God praise for them. So who needs a hero like that? A real-life hero, not a comic book fantasy. A real-life superhero who breaks through into this world and defeats enemies that we don't have any hope of defeating on our own. His name is Jesus. And on Easter, we celebrate his resurrection, which is the most important event in human history. What it can't be is moderately important. And when we discover its truth, like Thomas did, like Lee Strobel did, like C.S. Lewis did, like countless other intellectuals have who've actually taken the time to investigate objectively the evidence for the resurrection, they could never be the same again. They could never let it be moderately important anymore. So in this movie, Risen, the Roman soldier who's tough and strong and isn't going to leave any stone unturned, much to his surprise, there's a theme here, much to his surprise, discovers beyond a shadow of a doubt that Jesus, in fact, has risen from the dead. And it blows his mind. And he could never be the same again. It just couldn't be moderately important anymore. What about you? Take a look.
Welcome, Clemens. Come join us, brother. There are no enemies here.
Thomas, where have you been?
Is it a ransom?
Do not seek me. Do not follow or wander. Persecute no one on my behalf. I have seen two things which cannot reconcile. A man dead without question, and that same man alive again. I pursue him, the Nazarene, to ferret the truth. Clavius Aquila Valerius Niger. It's his seal, sir. Must be a plague.
My right hand turned against me. How could he follow that Hebrew?
Perhaps it's true.
It's true. And if it's true, it can't be moderately important. Consider the evidence. Take a closer look. Those of you who are doubters, I just encourage you, look into this. I think you'll be surprised. Like a long list of intellectuals before you have been surprised. If you're a fully devoted follower of Jesus, you believe it, you didn't need the evidence to believe it, that's great. But then again, we do. Because Christianity isn't just about us, it's about what we can share with the world around us, so now at least you're better equipped. You have a better sense of how to share the gospel with others who doubt, who are skeptical, who have questions. And this is just tip of the iceberg. There's not just exhibit A, B, C, and D, and E. There's the whole alphabet and then some. But I wanted to give you, I don't have 3 weeks to try this case. I've got one sermon. I wanted to give you a glimpse and begin to show you that the evidence is actually in the favor of the resurrection. When Thomas discovered that, when Clavius in that movie discovered that, when C.S. Lewis discovered that, when Lee Strobel discovered that, they could never be the same again. They knew now their sin is erased. It is crucified. It is put to death. It's not held against you anymore. They knew that death wasn't the end. At the end of 1 Corinthians 15, the Apostle Paul famously writes, "Oh, death, where's your sting now? In light of the resurrection, you have no power because death has been overcome. The victory has been won. Jesus Christ lived and died and rose from the dead for you." There's nothing moderately important about that good news. It changes everything. It gives us new life and eternal life. And so Jesus says to you today, like he said to Peter, like he said to Mary, like he said to John, like he said to Thomas, follow me. Follow me. And I'll show you the life that your soul's been looking for your whole life. And it isn't to live a life to see, how much can I consume? How much can I get from you? How much can I take for the glory of me? It's to live for the glory of God and to serve others. Only then will we discover the stride we've been created to walk and to hit. Only then will we have a soul that's fully satisfied when we realize Jesus is the way, he is the truth, he is the resurrection and the life. This man, he lived, he died, and he rose from the dead. And all the evidence points to this undeniable truth. And if it's true, it can't be moderately important. And so, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, if you believe it, after I say he is risen, shout it out, say he is risen indeed. He is risen.
He is risen.
He is risen.
He is risen.
I rest my case. Let's stand up and give God praise.
Thank you so much for tuning in and joining us for Service Online.
If this is your first time joining us, welcome. We don't think it's any accident that you're here, and we have been praying for you.
To see more of our content, know when we go live, and stay up to date week to week, feel free to subscribe to this channel.
And if you live close by one of our campuses or local sites, we invite you to check us out in person. We would love to meet you. And don't forget to follow us on social media to stay up to date.
See you next week.